First, I'd like to return Michael's compliments, his decision to contact me and to start an initially virtual, yet immediately very lively and highly focused dialogue about Barnett Newman's paintings has been an intellectual gift for me. He has challenged me to rethink a number of popular assumptions that I had been reiterating quite uncritically about concepts such as intention and perception. It was also revealing, a revealing experience that this essay I wrote, my first publication in English, directly entered into an international discussion on the works of Barnett Newman. I mention this because I think it shows again the necessity of finding a lingua franca in research, not in order to say the same things or to utilize the same frameworks, but rather in order to understand each other's scholarship well enough to actually be able to tease out the differences, which in Michael's and my case are quite subtle, but still very important. So I commend the Terra Foundation for their regular support of translations into and from English, and I hope they'll keep up the work because I think it's really important. Michael and I provide two different approaches to Newman's work, which can be understood as two different applications of what has been called formalist criticism. And our different approaches might in the end make it necessary to discuss how valid the concept of one formalism really is, and if we should not rather accept that there is a number of different formalist methodologies. But I will get back to the question of our respective scholarly contexts and theoretical backgrounds later on. First, I'll try to do Michael's essay justice by formulating, in way of a response to his review, a number of issues that seem to be fundamental to his thinking about not only Newman's painting, but also art in general. Michael's essay is called Barnett Newman's Sense of Space, a Non-Contextualist Account of Its Perception and Meaning. It seems to me to be a purposeful irritation to announce one's discussion of an artist's sense of space to be non-contextualist. Because doesn't space entail context? With context, I mean first, the physical surrounding of a work of art, second, the discursive reality of spatial perception, which, third, is historically and culturally determined. While the physical space of an artwork might still be discussed in a phenomenological and largely ahistorical manner, perception, to my mind, is historically determined and thus changing continually. So there we disagree. It is noteworthy that Michael's account is not just non-contextual, but actually non-contextualist, which for me gives evidence of the significance of this differentiation. A contextualist interpretation of Newman's art makes the artwork's meaning contingent. Contingent on individual experiences that are dependent on the respective viewer's context. This approach seems unproductive to Michael because methodologically, one has no way of verifying individual perceptual experiences, and systematically, the question remains as to whether an understanding of contextually contingent perceptions can give an indication of an artist's intended experience. In Newman's case, the artist's own writings have regularly been employed in order to pinpoint this intended experience. Since the 1940s until his death in 1970, Newman was a regular and opinionated contributor to the heated contemporary discourse on art, its perception, and the meaning of this experience. This proliferation of artistic statements has in effect led many scholars to make use of Newman's writing as the most prominent basis for the interpretation of his artistic work. One example for that would be Sebastian Egenhofer, or even more narrowly, to assess his painting as an illustration of his theory, and an unsuccessful illustration at that. One example for that would be Paul Crowther. Michael and I share the strong conviction that this approach does not do justice to either the paintings or the writings of Barnett Newman. I thus find myself in complete agreement with Michael's decision methodologically to distance writings from artworks in his essay, and initially to analyze Newman's paintings as if there did not exist any interpretory guidelines formulated by the artist himself. Michael offers a close analysis of three paintings by Barnett Newman, all of the year 1950, in order to carve out their spatial perception as intended by the artist. He thus assumes that it is possible to deduce an artistic intention with regard to perceptual experience solely from the formal analysis of these paintings. the works Michael chooses for his argument are radically different from one another. The Wild is extremely narrow, Untitled 2 has a prominently deep frame, and Vir Heroicus Sublimis measures nearly 18 feet in width, which is why this slide looks so ridiculous. But I wanted to give an understanding of the differences of scale, but I have the next slide, which at least might give you a bit more of an impression of the depth of Untitled 2, so you get a little bit of an understanding. All three formats, according to Michael, allow for specific spatial perceptual experiences. In The Wild, it is the feeling that the painting somehow vaults over you as it leaves your visual range in vertical orientation. In Untitled 2, it is the necessity to include your experience into your experience, not just the perception of the image, but also the physical depth of the frame, which juts out into the gallery space 3 inches deep. In Vir Heroicus Sublimis, it is the experience of being unfolded by Newman's color, yet perceptually structured by his zips. All three of these perceptual experiences involve a spatial relationship between artwork and observer. They offer a mode of perception which is consummated by their audience. If I understand Michael correctly, it is within this mode of perception laid out in the artwork to be enabled by the viewer that the artist's intention might be gathered and the painting's meaning might be experienced. Not understood or found, but rather faced, which is a Freudian term, so we could talk about that too. Here, Michael's very convincing and enviously precise descriptions and analyses of Newman's paintings converge with the artist's own aims and claims. Though methodologically, Michael has arrived at this interpretation of Newman's mode of perception, seemingly without taking into account the artist's statement, they now corroborate his reading of Newman's non-contextualist sense of space. And here, our viewpoints differ slightly, but significantly. Though I make similar observations in my analysis of Vir Heroicus Sublimis and The Wild with regard to their integration of space, I arrive at a different interpretation of these specific modes of spatial perception. My conclusion is closer to that of Yves Alain Bois, whose research is a common reference point both for Michael and myself, though I think you read him much more skeptically than I do. For Bois, Newman's artworks necessitate a process of perception because they do not follow the conventions of spatial illusion. The viewer is challenged to visually position him or herself in front of the artwork, but instead of finding one spot, the process of perception continues as figure and ground continue to cancel each other out. This argument is supported, in my view, by the fact that The Wild, Vir Heroicus Sublimis, and Untitled 2 are extreme interpretations of the genre of painting. They are extremely narrow, extremely wide, or extremely object-like. While without a doubt being subtle and well-executed paintings, they also come very close to being a relief, a mural, or an object in space. In my opinion, Newman arrived at this ambiguity of perception then by allowing for an ambiguity of his chosen artistic medium, painting. This artistic strategy finds its logical continuation in the sculpture Here One, which Newman also made in 1950, in parallel with the paintings we've already been talking about. This sculpture clearly references the painterly characteristics of Newman's painting while positioning itself just as clearly in the tradition of three-dimensional art. It serves as evidence for Newman's interest in the production of perception in its parameters of time and space. Bois, Michael, and I seem to agree that Newman's work necessitates a process of perception, which involves both immersion and distance. Michael, however, is unhappy with Bois' claim that there is no natural endpoint to this visual challenge. To Michael, it thus becomes a confrontational negative setting, which he argues would not fit with Newman's more positive enterprise. Newman wanted his paintings to make a viewer aware of his or her individual self, a self that Newman imagined as not socially constructed or culturally assigned, but one produced in the security of a meaningful relationship between artwork and viewer. Newman's writings here serve Michael as complementary evidence, since Newman himself continued to stress the point that the meaning of his art was in the individual event of perceiving it. In my opinion, however, Newman's interest in publicly commenting on his work in numerous different publication formats served a rather pragmatic aim. Newman is part of a discourse on contemporary painting, the discourse of Clement Greenberg and Michael Fried, of Thomas Hess and Harold Rosenberg, and a little later of artists like Donald Judd and critics such as Robert Rosenblum. The concept of the sublime, especially as it is combined by Newman rhetorically with the notion of space and an individual's recognition of being situated in that space, serves him not only to express his artistic intention. This rhetoric also allows him to differentiate his artistic practice from what he considers meaningless formal exercises on the one side, and Mondrian serves as his negative example, as well as processual, site-specific, and anti-aesthetic experiences of minimalist objects, on the other. These objects have triggered the well-known controversy between Michael Fried and Donald Judd, who, by the way, considered Newman as a major influence to his artistic practice. In contrast to Michael's non-contextualist interpretation, I argue then that there are two spheres where context necessarily enters the discussion. First, due to their criticism of pictorial perception, Newman's works necessitate a mode of perception that requires spatial reorientation in the gallery room. Second, Newman's self-commentary positions his artwork in the context of the historical discourse on painting during the 1950s and 60s. For me, Newman's artistic as well as his aesthetic practice take part in a critical discourse on the conventions of perception, and they both follow the rules of each particular discourse. Could I have the next slide? In my own research, I have positioned Newman in a much broader historical context, as I wanted to understand the relationship of his painterly work to other modes of perception put forth by artistic movements after abstract expressionism and color field painting, namely minimal art and land art. For me, the link between these artistic positions is a critical preoccupation with the parameters and the production of perception. This interest was countered in the artist's statements with a testimony for the meaningfulness of the individual instance of perception. Both artistic expression and artistic writing grapple with the conventions of pictorial perception and present modes of experiences that are decidedly unconventional. It was then enlightening for me to read the other articles written by American scholars on Newman's The Wild, specifically Kenan R. Allen's Barnett Newman's The Wild, Painting as a Spatial Intervention caught my attention, as he seems to grapple with issues related to Michael's interests and, like me, attempts to establish a connection between Newman's work and post-minimalist positions. For him, the connection is between Richard Long and Daniel Buren. Allen's title can be read as a response to Michael's essay, Spatial Intervention versus Non-Contextualism. And already in the second paragraph, Allen states his most prominent thesis, namely that The Wild is, I quote, context-dependent. Michael was so kind to send me his PDF of that article, and of course he doubly underlined that claim. There is a lot to argue about with Allen. I would agree. For example, he connects Newman's narrow painting, The Wild, with Richard Long's conceptual performance piece, Walking a Line in Peru, claiming that both works, I quote, have the potential to direct attention away from themselves. Clearly, this parallelism is forced, a faulty shortcut, as we are talking about a narrow painted canvas on the one hand and the black and white photograph of an installation of stones on the other. Also, Allen's choice of comparison seems random. It is not at all clear why next to Long, the French artist Daniel Buren is called up as a witness to attest to Newman's conceptuality avant la lettre. The only thing these three artists have in common is the interest in the vertical field, too superficial a parallel to serve as a convincing argument, in my mind. And lastly, I agree with Yves Alain Bois, he also commented on this article, who criticized that by retroactively framing Newman's paintings as anticipatory, minimal, or conceptual pieces, Allen diminished their painterly accomplishments. However, though I'm very much in disagreement with Allen, I still think that there is value in contextualizing Newman's work with artistic positions that grapple with the question of perception and its pictorial conventions. So, from the other side of the Atlantic, I'm left to wonder why this interest in context and the claim of artistic autonomy need to be so mutually exclusive? And I wonder if these exclusions are really productive as frameworks of research. I operate from the premise that formalism and historicity do not cancel each other out. In my own work, I argue that Newman literalizes pictorial space, which is why perception becomes a matter of process and does involve a more active audience. I support my argument with a close formal analysis of the paintings and their internal relationships, as well as the repetition of these painterly conventions outside of the painting, its relations to the wall, and its revisions in sculpture. For me, it is the very subtle transferal of modes of pictorial perception into spatial negotiations that makes Newman's handling of visual experience so exciting. The frontal view of Here One shows, for example, how Newman transfers the originally pictorial question of illusionary space into three-dimensionality. Two narrow posts are covered with plaster and intimately connect with the white wall behind, which serves as their background. The posts seem to blend into the wall as a color field behind them, or to be attached to it as reliefs. From this frontal perspective, the interpretation of the posts as direct translations of Newman's painterly zips into the third dimension seems comprehensive, especially because the posts showed those painterly characteristics, for example, feathers versus clean edges or different widths, that the painterly zips feature as well. However, although the frontal view of Here One implies that Newman's sculpture deals with traditionally pictorial questions, the three-dimensionality of the sculpture, as well as the discreteness of its respective parts, cannot be ignored. Looking at Here One's elaborate base, one becomes aware of the distance between the entire sculpture and the wall. In Here One, then, the suggestion and the simultaneous refusal of spatial illusion, which was already observed in Newman's color field paintings, is fixed in sculptural three-dimensional form. I also think that this is why artists such as Donald Judd were fascinated by Newman's work. This does not mean that he was a minimalist avant la lettre. I turn this argument upside down and argue that not only Newman, but also a number of minimalists and representatives of land art, for that matter, were preoccupied with a perception of the world that was influenced by and dependent on pictorial conventions. The transferal of pictorial negotiations of space into three-dimensionality was something that was shared by these generations of artists in the USA, as were the artists' decisions to counter this reflexive stance of their works with a rhetoric of sublimity, an immediate and overwhelming aesthetic experience. All of the artists I dealt with in my research indicate in their own words how their artistic work, I quote, means something beyond their formal extremes. So, as my approach is clearly not as non-contextualist as Michael's, where does that leave me in regard to formalism? I would regard myself as partly formalist because I base my research on the analysis of an artwork, which is not defined solely by context or author, but has an existence of its own, which can be described in isolation. But at the same time, I'm convinced that this artistic entity and its audience are integrated into a historical context. Formalism, to me, is thus a question of methodology. I find it productive to begin my work with an analysis and the modes of perception the artwork might trigger. I think that these modes of perception, which in Newman's case are a critical reevaluation of the convention of spatial illusion, and connected with this, the imperative to reflect upon one's process of perception while perceiving, that these function as a stepping stone to reach beyond formal analysis. The question how we perceive is a cultural and a social one, and it is historically specific. This does not mean to degrade Newman's artistic work, or his writings for that matter, to a mere illustration of larger cultural phenomena, nor does it make his statements fraudulent or untrustworthy. I do think artistic production is such an important object of study because it positions itself between artistic aims and audiences' reality, and because it continues to close that gap, even though its breadth and depth change constantly. There's an element in art that cannot be explained by any context, be it art historical, cultural, social, geographical, or historical. I would argue that this excess of meaning is due to an artwork's formal specificity, its material qualities, which physically distance it from easy integration into whichever context is at hand. Still, I'm not willing to work as a non-contextualist. The scholarly questions I'm asking actually develop mostly out of an interest in the artistic and discursive connections between artistic developments over both historical and geographical distances. The question that I have asked myself in preparation of this event was if it might be easier as a Central European to enter the methodological minefield between formalism and cultural studies with some nonchalance. Two arguments in favor of this more comfortable vantage point come to my mind. First, German-speaking research is very much influenced by hermeneutics, and much more recently by theories of aesthetic experience. The conditionality of interpretation is at the core of both theoretical approaches. Hans-Georg Gadamer insists in his treatise Wahrheit und Methode from 1960 on the differences between an artwork and its context. But at the same time, he emphasizes the historicity of any experience of that artwork. He calls this Verstehenshorizont, the horizon of one's individual comprehension, which one can never leave. The artwork then exists to him in its contextually specific enactment. It is realized and thus interpreted whenever it is being perceived. More recently, Juliane Rebentisch, in her book Die Ästhetik der Installation from 2003, proposed a reformulation of artistic autonomy in her analysis of installation art, a decidedly non-autonomous artistic genre. She argues that autonomy may not be understood as a characteristic of the artwork, but instead as a quality of aesthetic experience. It is in the perception of the artwork that each individual viewer experiences autonomy. According to Rebentisch, aesthetic experience is produced in the event of perception between artwork and viewer, who are both transformed in the process. As is it perceived, the object becomes an artwork, and as one perceives, one realizes one's constitutive role in this production of meaning. Neither is autonomy then tied to an artistic object, as in modernism, nor is it dissolved in cross-media installation, as in postmodernism. Instead, it is produced in the activity of perception. So this specific kind of experience is that an artwork can produce is to her where autonomy might still be found. Both propositions clearly opt for the compatibility of formalism and historicity, and both provide methodological tools to do so. Gadamer demands the reflection of one's own historicity as a viewer. Rebentisch argues for the reassessment of aesthetic experience. My reading of American formalism filters through these ideas, which brings me to my second argument as to why I have fewer qualms connecting artwork with context. I look at formalism as a decidedly historical practice, as one of several tools available to art historians, rather than an ideology of what art is or how it operates. To me, the Michael Fried who has written Art and Objecthood in 1967 is as much a figure of historical discourse as is Theodor Adorno, whose Ästhetische Theorie was published posthumously in 1970. Though I disagree with Fried's historically explainable negativity toward minimal art, I take away from his approach a turn toward the formal description of perception, which seems far removed from Greenberg's earlier assertion of painting's self-criticism. And though I have trouble with Adorno's, again, historically explainable cultural conservatism, I find productive his description of art as both autonomous and social fact. For Adorno, the unresolved antagonisms of reality reappear in art as its internal problems of form. Again, the formal analysis of an artwork and its perception is at the basis of this approach. These texts and many more have shaped my formalism, but understanding them as a historical source rather than a tool in and of themselves gives me the freedom to open up my own field of research much further than Fried and Adorno would have appreciated. I can, and I do, work on topics as far apart as 19th century portrait photography and the performance installations of the contemporary artist Mike Kelly. My interest in these diverse subjects is due to their imminent refusal to fulfill their respective pictorial function, to be a representative portrait on the one hand, in the case of Queen Victoria, it's not a very representative portrait, or to be a contemporary artwork on the other, rather than a social outreach center. Due to their material specificity and formal layout, which conjures up conventions that are then not redeemed, these works produce an excess of meaning that is not easily integrated into, but at the same time does not exist outside of its respective contexts.